locked up.
He points to the window, and his sudden urgency scares me. I never thought he'd be this serious, that he'd really want to do it. But now he's talking like we could march down there and end her life right now, all based on my ability to see what she really is. And you could live with yourself after that? I ask, knowing you killed 3 people?
My brother is dead, he says coldly. I came here to find out what happened to him, and I did. I can't just walk away now.
He removes the hat from his head and drops it onto the chair.
I have to do this, Penny.
You don't. I move closer to him. At least not right now. Not tonight. Maybe we can find another way. He exhales, then leans into the window frame.
There isn't another way.
I reach out and touch his arm, forcing him to look at me. Please, I say, tilting my chin up at him. He smells like the earth. He smells wild and fearless, and I know he could also be dangerous. But when I'm this close to him, I don't care what he is. We still have a few days until the solstice. There's time to figure something out. All those books in your cottage, maybe there really is a way to stop the sisters without killing the girls they've taken. We have to look. We have to try. My fingers slide down to his hand, the warmth of his palm burning me, setting me on fire, making me dizzy.
Okay, he answers, tightening his fingers through mine. We'll look for another way. But if we don't find one...
I know, I say, before he can finish. He will kill Gigi Klein just to get to Aurora. But he doesn't fully understand what that will mean. Taking a life. It will change him. It's not something he can take back. The sun has managed to sink into the ocean in the span of time that we've been in my room, and I switch on the lamps on either side of my bed.
One of us should stay up to watch the cottage. Make sure she doesn't sneak out, Beau says.
I doubt she'll try to escape, but I nod anyway, agreeing. Her odds aren't good back in town. Lon and Davis are surely looking for her, and I'm guessing she knows she's safer here, hidden in the cottage. Her mistake is that she thinks we'll protect her from them, especially with Rose on her side, when in fact, we're plotting ways in which to end her life. Sisters. Magic is not always formed from words, from cauldrons brewing spices, or black cats strolling down dark alleys. Some curses are manifested from desire or injustice. When she was alive, Aurora Swan would sometimes leave shards of broken glass or a rat's tail on the doorstep of a woman who hated her, hoping an illness might befall the woman, or she might stumble on a loose stone while strolling down Ocean Avenue and break her neck. They were merely small omens, common hexes of the day to bend fate in her favor, not real magic. Hazel Swan could often be found whispering wishes onto a blood moon, her lips as swift as a hummingbird in flight. She enchanted the moon, wishing for things she craved, a real love to wipe all the others away. Marguerite was more direct in her efforts. She would slide her fingers along her lover's throats, tell them that they were hers, and if they refused her, she would ensure they never loved anyone else ever again. She promised revenge and torment, and the full wrath of her fury if they dared deny her. She swished through town as if she were made of the finest French silk, arrogant and imperious. She wanted power. And everyone knew it. But their hubris would eventually catch up to them. The sisters might have portrayed themselves scandalously, wicked and witchy, but they never practiced magic in a way that justified their demise. They were not witches, in a historical sense, but they did have a gravity about them, a thing that pulled you in. They moved with a graceful ease, as though they were trained ballerinas from the Académie Royale de Danse in France. Their hair was a hue that wavered between caramel and carmine, depending on the sunlight, and their voices had the sing-song of a whistling thrush, each word a fascination. They never stole the souls of newborn babies, or cast potent spells to make the rains unending or the fish in the harbor uncatchable. Nor had they the skills to spin a curse as everlasting as the one that bound them now. But magic was not always so linear. It was born from odium, from love, from revenge. Chapter 15. At 2 a.m. on the dot, my eyelids flutter open. The room is dark except for the angular shape of moonlight spilling across the floor from the window. The rain clouds are gone, and the sky has split open. Beau is awake, sitting in the chair, finger tapping slowly and rhythmically on the armrest. He turns his head when I sit up in bed. "You should have woken me sooner," I say drowsily.
"You seemed like you needed sleep."
I'm still fully dressed under the blankets, and I kick back the layers and stretch my arms in the air. "I'll take the next shift," I say. The wood floor is cold and creaking beneath the weight of my feet. "You must be tired." He yawns and stands up. We bump shoulders as we try to move around one another, both of us sleepy. And when he gets to the bed, he collapses onto his back, one hand on his chest, the other stretched out at his side. He pulls his hat down over his face. I'm tempted to crawl back onto the bed beside him, rest my head on his shoulder and doze back into my dreams. It would be easy to let myself surrender to him, both in this moment and forever. Let the days flit away until there are no more days left to count. I could leave this island with him and not look back, and maybe, possibly, I could be happy. It doesn't take long for Beau's hands to relax, his head to shift slightly to the left, and I know he's asleep. But I don't settle into the chair. I walk to the door, opening it just wide enough to slip out into the hall. I move silently down the stairs to the front door. A few intermittent clouds pass beneath the moon, then reveal it again. A ballet of clear sky mixed with low clouds, washed in moonlight. I wrestle into my raincoat, trying to move quickly, and then hurry out into the night, headed to Old Fisherman's Cottage. It takes several tries before I'm able to dislodge the board from under the doorknob. My hands are wet, the wood board is wet, and when the door creaks open, the only light inside the cottage is from the fireplace across the room. It smells like mildew and mothballs, and a little like vinegar, and for a half second, I feel bad for Gigi being trapped inside this place. She is standing across the small room, awake, holding her palms over the fire for warmth. "Hello, Penny," she says without turning around. I close the door behind me, shaking the rain from my coat. "I didn't kill his brother." "Maybe not," I answer, "but he's determined to find out who did." Instinctively, I want to move to the fire for warmth, but I also don't want to be any nearer to her than I already am. On the couch, I notice the folded-up blanket I brought her earlier. She hasn't slept at all. "Did you come to invite me up to your house for tea and a shower? I could really use a shower."
"No."
"Then why are you here?" She pivots around, her shoulder-length, straight blonde hair hanging frayed and dirty like the bristles on a broom. Again, I stifle back the sensation of feeling sorry for her. She blinks, and the flickering, silvery-gray outline of Aurora Swan beneath her skin blinks, too. They are like two girls transposed over top of each other, two photo images developed all wrong, one hovering over the other. But when Gigi turns away from the firelight, I almost can't see Aurora inside her. The outlines of her face fade and turn shadowy. I could fool myself into believing that Aurora is no longer there and Gigi is just a normal girl. "I need to talk to you."
"Without your boyfriend?"
she asks, the left side of her lip arching up at the edge.
He wants to kill you. The whole town does. They always have. That's nothing new. In the corner of the ceiling behind her is a cobweb, partly decayed, dark specks, flies and moths, trapped in the sticky remains. Doomed. Legs and wings stuck. The spider is long dead, but the web keeps on killing. But this time they caught you swimming back to shore after drowning two boys. They're certain you're one of them. Her eyebrows come together, forming a line that rises up into her forehead. And I'm sure you've done nothing to encourage that idea. She's implying that I've said something, revealed that she is indeed a Swan Sister, but I've only told Beau. Aren't you tired of this? I ask. Of killing people year after year? This is what I had wanted to say when I confronted her at the boathouse, before Long caught me talking to her. She looks intrigued. Her head tilts to the left. You say it like we have a choice. What if we do? Don't forget, she says crisply. It's your fault we ended up like this in the first place. I drop my gaze to the floor. Dust motes have collected around the legs of the kitchen table and against the walls. She smiles, then rolls her tongue against her cheek. Let me guess. You're falling in love with that boy? Her mouth turns up again, grinning with satisfaction that she's hit on something that makes me uncomfortable. And you're starting to think that maybe there's a way to keep this body you're in, to stay human forever? She steps away from the fire, pushing her lower jaw out like she might laugh. You're fucking naive, Hazel. You always have been. Even back then, you thought this town wouldn't actually kill us. You thought we could be saved. But you were wrong. Stop it, I tell her, my lips trembling. This isn't your town. That isn't your body. These people hate us. They want us dead all over again, and you're pretending that you're one of them. She lifts her chin in the air like she's trying to see me from a new angle, spy the thing inside me. And that boy, Beau, he doesn't love you. He loves who he thinks you are. Penny Talbot, the girl whose body you stole. The words are spit from her lips like they taste vile on her tongue. And now you've locked up your own sister in this disgusting cottage. You've betrayed us. Your whole family. You're dangerous, I manage to say. So are you. She laughs. Tell me, were you planning on going the whole season without drowning a single boy? The solstice is coming. I'm done with that, I say. I don't want to kill anymore. Even though the urge gnaws at me, tugging at my soul, the need like a thorn at the back of my throat always pricking the skin, reminding me of what I'm here to do. But I have resisted. At times, I've even forgotten. With Beau, the desire for revenge has been dulled. He's made me believe I can be someone else, not just the monster I've become. You have to. It's what we do. She twirls a strand of blonde hair through her thumb and index finger, pressing her lips together into a pout. Aurora's face seems to push against the inside of Gigi's skull, like she's trying to find more space, stretch her neck a little within the confines of her body. I know the feeling. Sometimes I feel trapped in Penny's body as well, imprisoned by the outline of her skin. We've been living like this for too long, I say, my voice stronger now, finding purpose in the words. 2 centuries of torturing this town, and what has it gotten us? You fall for some boy who's not even a local, and now suddenly you want to protect this town? She folds her arms over her chest, still wearing the same soiled white blouse as when she drowned those boys in the water. And besides, I like coming back. I like making boys fall in love with me, controlling them, collecting them like little trophies. You like killing them, you mean? I make them mine, and I deserve to keep them, she snaps. It's not my fault they're so trusting and gullible. Boys are weak. They were 2 centuries ago, and they still are. When will it be enough?
Never. She cants her head to the side, cracking her neck. I exhale. What did I expect coming in here? What was I hoping for? I should have known. My sisters will never stop. They have become just like the sea, breaking apart ships and lives without remorse. And they'll keep on killing for another 2 centuries if they have their way. I turn for the door.
Haven't you learned your lesson, Hazel? She says from across the room. You were betrayed by the boy you loved once before. What makes you think Beau won't betray you too?
I bite down on the fury boiling inside me. She doesn't know anything about what happened before, 2 centuries ago. This is different, I say. Beau is different.
Unlikely, but he is cute.
She smirks.
Maybe too cute for you. I think I should have him.
Stay away from him, I bark. Her eyes turn to slits, narrowed on me.
What exactly do you plan on doing with him?
I won't kill him. I won't take him into the sea and drown him. I don't want that for him. A dark, watery existence. His soul trapped in the harbor. A prisoner shifting with the tide.
You realize that you're just going to have to leave him behind in a few days. And he will have fallen in love with a ghost and be left with the body of this girl Penny who won't remember a thing.
She lets out a short laugh.
Won't that be hilarious? He will be in love with Penny, not you.
A rattling of nausea starts to rise in my gut.
He loves me, not this body.
But the words sound feeble and broken.
Sure, she says, and her eyes roll in her head. Such a Gigi thing to do.
We can't help but take on the mannerisms of the bodies we inhabit, just as I have taken on the traits of Penny Talbot. All of her memories sit dormant in my mind, waiting to be plucked like a flower from the ground. I am playing the part of Penny Talbot, and I do it well. I've had practice. I touch the doorknob.
I meant what I said, I say back to her.
Stay away from him, or I'll make sure those boys in town get the opportunity to do exactly what they've been dying to do. Kill you. She chuckles, but then her gaze turns serious, watching me as I slip out the door and kick it shut behind me.
Hazel Swan. Hazel was walking swiftly down Ocean Avenue. A small package containing a vial of rose water and myrrh perfume held delicately between her hands. She was on her way to deliver it to Mrs. Campbell in Alder Hill. She had glanced down at the package, expertly wrapped in brown butcher paper, when she smacked right into the hard shoulder of someone standing on the sidewalk. The package slipped from her fingers and broke on the cobblestone street. The scent of rose and myrrh evaporated swiftly into the soggy seaside air. Owen Clement knelt down to scoop up the remains of the package, and Hazel did the same, her arm grazing his, their fingers touching and soaking up the perfume. Hazel had always avoided the fervent affections of men, unlike her sisters, and so she wasn't prepared for the desire that twined through her upon meeting Owen Clement, the son of the first lighthouse keeper who lived on Lumiere Island. He was French, like his father, and words rolled from his tongue like a sanguine breeze. Nightly, Hazel began sneaking across the harbor to the island, hands pressed to skin and tangled in each other's hair, bodies formed as one, waking each morning in the loft above the barn that stood near the main farmhouse, the air smelling of hay and sweat. The chickens clucked from their pen below, and in the evenings, with only the moonlight to reveal their faces, they wandered the single row of young apple tree saplings that Owen's father had planted that spring. It would still be several years before they would turn a harvest, but the promise of what they would bring felt ripe and sharp in the air. Together, they explored the rocky coastline. They let the water lap against their feet.
They imagined a new life together, farther south. California, maybe. They threw flat stones into the water, and they made wishes for impossible things. But Owen's father distrusted the Swan sisters, who were rumored to be witches, temptresses who lured boys into their beds just for amusement. And when he discovered his son and Hazel folded together in the loft one morning, he swore he would make sure they never saw each other again. It was Owen's father who mounted the Inquisition into the three sisters. It was Owen's father who tied the stones around their ankles that pulled the three girls to the bottom of the harbor. It was Owen's father who was responsible for their deaths. And year after year, summer after summer, Hazel feels drawn back to Lumiere Island, reminded of the boy who she loved in that place, who she forged promises with, and who she lost 2 centuries ago. Chapter 16. Beau is still asleep on the bed when I get back to the room. The sky turned dark on my way back to the house, rain once again blowing across the island. His chest expands with each breath. His lips fall open. I watch him, wishing I could tell him the truth without destroying everything, without destroying him. But he thinks I'm someone else. When he looks at me, he sees Penny Talbot, not Hazel Swan. I have carried the lie around as if it were the truth, pretended that this body could actually be mine and that I wouldn't have to return to the sea at the end of June if I believed it hard enough. Maybe this feeling blooming inside my chest will save me. Maybe the way Beau looks at me will make me real and whole, not the girl who drowned 200 years ago. But Gigi's laugh rings in my ear. It's what we do. We're killers. Our revenge will never be satiated. And I can never have Beau. Not really. I'm trapped in another girl's body. I've been repeating the same endless cycle summer after summer. I am not me. I hardly know who I am anymore. I walk to the white dresser against the far wall and run a finger along the surface. A collection of items lie scattered like fragments of a story. Vanilla perfume that once belonged to Penny's mom. Beach pebbles and shells in a dish. Her favorite books by John Steinbeck and Herman Melville and Neil Gaiman. Her past rests unprotected in the open, so easily stolen. I can make these things mine. I can make her life mine. This home, this bedroom, including the boy asleep on her bed. A photograph is tucked at the bottom corner of the mirror above the dresser. I pull it out. It's an image of a woman floating in a tank of water, a fake mermaid's tail fastened at her waist to conceal her legs. Men are gathered in front of the tank, staring in at her while she holds her breath, her expression soft and unrestrained. She is a lie, an invention used to sell tickets at a traveling carnival. I am her, a lie. But when the carnival closes for the night, all the lights flickered off and the water drained from the tank, I do not get to remove my fabric mermaid fin. I do not get to have a normal life outside of the illusion. I will always be someone else. My deception has lasted 200 years. I place the photo back at the edge of the mirror and rub my palms over my eyes. How did I become this thing? A spectacle, a sideshow curiosity. I didn't want any of this, this prolonged, unnatural life. I blow out a breath, keeping the tears from seeping to the surface, and turn to face Beau, who's still asleep. He twitches on the bed, then opens his eyes, as if he felt me watching him in his dreams. I flick my gaze away to the window. You all right? He sits up, pressing his palms into the mattress. Fine. But I'm not. This guilt is burying me alive. I'm choking on it, suffocating, swallowing down mouthfuls of each gravelly lie. Did you go outside? He asks. I touch my hair, wet from the rain.
just for a minute.
To Gigi's cottage?
I shake my head, pulling in my lips to hide the truth. I just wanted some fresh air. He believes me. Or maybe he's only pretending to believe me.
I'll stay up for a bit so you can sleep, he says.
I start to tell him no, then realize how exhausted I am. So I crawl onto the bed, knees drawn close to my chest. But I can't sleep. I watch him standing at the window, looking out at a world that I don't belong in. The sun will be up soon. The sky made new. And maybe I'll be made new, too. 3 days whirl by and fast forward. Rose comes to the island to check on Gigi, her freed prisoner. She brings forgetful cakes from her mom's shop, blackberry mocha and sea salt caramel with crushed pistachio. She tells us that Davis and Lon are searching for Gigi, that they're worried they'll get in trouble if she goes to the police and rats them out for keeping her locked up in the boathouse. Somehow, no one seems to suspect that she might be on Lumiere Island, secretly incarcerated in one of the cottages. Beau spreads out books on the floor of his cottage each evening, fire blazing, his eyes watering and tired from reading late into the night. He is searching for a way to kill the Swan Sisters, but save the bodies they inhabit. A pointless endeavor. I know things he doesn't. And I, secretly, am hoping for a way to keep this body forever. I read books, too, curled up on the couch, the wind rattling the cottage windows. But I'm looking for something else. A way to remain. To exist above the sea indefinitely. To live. There are legends of mermaids who fall in love with sailors, their devotion granting them a human form. I read about the Irish tales of Selkies shedding their sealskins, marrying a human man, and staying on land forever. Perhaps this one thing is enough. To fall in love? If love can bind something, can it also undo it? On the eve of the summer solstice, Beau passes out beside the fire with an open book on his chest. But I can't sleep. So I leave his cottage and wander up to the orchard alone. From the rows of trees, I can just barely make out Mom, Penny's mom, standing out on the cliff's edge, the shadow of a woman waiting for a husband who won't return. Seeing her out there, alone, her heart cleaved in half by pain, I could easily let the grief buried inside this body rise up to the surface. Not only are memories stored in the bodies we take, but emotions as well. I can feel them, resting broad and deep inside Penny's chest. If I look too close, if I peer into that darkness, I can feel the gaping sadness of losing her father. My eyes will swell with tears, an ache twisting in my heart, a longing so vast it could swallow me. So I keep it stuffed down. I don't let that part of the host body overcome me. But my sisters have always been better at it than me. They can ignore whatever past emotions have ruled the body, while I tend to feel the sorrow and grief creeping through my veins, up my throat, trying to choke me. I stop at the old oak tree at the center of the grove, the ghost tree, its leaves shivering in the wind. I press my palm against the heart carved into the trunk. I stare up through the limbs, a theater of stars blinking back at me. It reminds me of the night so many years ago, lying beneath this tree with the boy I once loved, Owen Clement. He held a knife in his hand and carved the heart there to mark our place in the world, our hearts bound together, eternity pumping through our veins. It was on that same night that he asked me to marry him. He had no ring or money or anything to offer except himself. But I said yes. A week later, my sisters and I were drowned in the harbor. Inquisition. A gust blew in through the open door of the perfumery, scattering dead leaves across the wood floor. 4 men stood in the doorway of the shop, muddy boots and filthy hands, stinking of fish and tobacco. Against the stark white walls and the air tinged with a delicate intermingling of perfumes, their presence was alarming. Hazel stared at their filthy boots and not their faces, thinking only of the soap and water she would need to scour the floor clean once they had left. She did not yet realize the men's intent, or that she would never see the perfumery again. The men grabbed the sisters by their forearms and dragged them from the shop. The Swan sisters were being arrested. They were hauled down Ocean Avenue for everyone to see. Fat drops of rain spat down from the sky. Muck from the street stained the hems of their dresses. The townspeople stopped to gawk. Some followed them all the way to the small town hall that was used for town meetings, a gathering place during bad storms, and occasionally, but quite rarely, also for legal disputes. A squabble over a missing goat, disagreements over dock anchorage, or property lines with neighbors. Never before had an accused witch been brought into the building, let alone three. A group of selectmen and town elders had already gathered, awaiting the Swan sisters' arrival. Marguerite, Aurora, and Hazel were brought before them and made to sit in three wood chairs at the front of the room, their hands tied behind them. A bird fluttered in the rafters, a yellow finch, trapped just like the sisters. Quickly, the women of Sparrow came forward, pointing fingers at Marguerite and occasionally Aurora, telling lurid tales of their misdeeds, their infidelity with the husbands and brothers and sons of this town, and how no woman could be so enchanting on her own. It surely must have been witchcraft that made the Swan sisters so irresistible to the poor, unwilling men in town. They were merely the victims of the sisters' black magic. "Witches," they hissed. The sisters weren't allowed to speak, even though Aurora tried more than once. Their words could not be trusted. Too easily spells could be uttered from their lips to charm those in the room, and then they could use their power to demand they be released. They were lucky, one of the selectmen said, that they hadn't been gagged. But there was another voice, one of the elders, a man who was blind in one eye, and would often be seen standing on the docks staring out at the Pacific, longing for the days he once spent at sea. His voice rose above the others. "Proof," he called. "We must have proof." This single demand forced silence through the courthouse, overflowing with spectators. A crowd pushed against the doors outside, straining to hear the first ever witch trial in the town of Sparrow. "I've seen Marguerite's mark," a man called from the back of the room. "On her left thigh, there was a birthmark shaped like a raven." This man, who had emboldened himself to speak at the urging of his wife, had shared a bed with Marguerite some months back. Marguerite's eyes went wide, and fury brewed behind them. She did, in fact, have a birthmark, but to call it the shape of a raven was the result of a clever imagination. The mark was more of an ink blot, but it made no difference. A mark of nearly any kind was considered the brand of a witch, proof she belonged to a coven, and Marguerite could not wipe away that which she was born with. "What of the other two?" the half-blind elder called. "Aurora," spoke a much quieter voice, a boy of only 18, "has a mark on her shoulder. I've seen it." And he had, as he had claimed, seen the collection of freckles on her right shoulder. His lips had pressed against her flesh on several nights previous, tracing the freckles that dotted much of Aurora's skin. She was like a galaxy, speckled with stars. Aurora's gaze met the boy's. She could see the fear obvious in his eyes. He believed Aurora might in truth be a witch as the town had claimed, and perhaps she had used dark magic on him, making his heart race whenever she was near. "Two honorable men have stepped forward with proof of guilt for two of the accused before us," said one of the selectmen. "What of the last sister, Hazel Swan? Surely someone has spied the mark of a coven on this enchantress's skin." A stir of whispers carried through the room and echoed off the steep ceiling.
voices trying to discern whom among them might have found themselves ensnared by Hazel, coaxed to her bed unwittingly.
"My son will tell you,"
a man's deep voice broke through the chatter. Owen's father appeared at the back of the courthouse, and trailing behind him, head down, was Owen.
"My son has been with her. He has seen what marks she conceals."
The air inside the room condensed. The damp walls stiffened. The yellow finch caught in the rafters fell quiet. Not even the floorboards creaked as Owen was pulled by his father to the front of the courthouse. Hazel Swan looked as if she might faint. Her complexion drained of all color. Not from fear for herself, but fear for Owen.
"Tell them," his father barked.
Owen stood stone-faced, eyes locked on Hazel. He would not. His father marched up to where the sisters sat in a row, hands bound by rope. He drew a large knife from the sheath at his waist and placed it to Hazel's throat, blade pressing against her alabaster skin. Her breath hitched, her eyes quivered, but did not stray from Owen's gaze.
"Stop!"
Owen cried, stepping toward Hazel. Two men grabbed his arms and held him in place.
"Tell us what you've seen," his father demanded. "Tell us of the marks that riddle this girl's body."
"There are no marks," Owen shouted back.
"Her spell on you has made you weak. Now tell us, or I will cut her throat and you will watch her bleed out, here in front of everyone. A painful death, I assure you."
"You will kill her anyway," Owen said. "If I speak, you will accuse her of being a witch."
"So you have seen something?"
the half-blind elder asked. Those in the room that day would later say it was as if Hazel Swan was conjuring a spell before their eyes. The way she peered at Owen, forcing his lips to remain silent. But others, the few who had known real love, saw something else. The look of two people whose love was about to destroy them. It was not witchcraft in Hazel's eyes. It was her heart splitting in half. And then Hazel spoke, a soft series of words that sounded almost like tears streaming down her cheeks.
"It's all right. Tell them."
"No,"
Owen answered back. He was still being held by the two men, his arms tensed against their grip.
"Please,"
she whispered, because she feared he might be punished for protecting her. She knew it was already too late. The town had decided. They were witches. The selectmen just needed Owen to say it, to prove what they already believed. He only needed to tell them of one little mark. Any imperfection on the skin would do. His eyes watered, and his lips fell open, the air hanging there for several breaths, several heartbeats, until he uttered, "There is a small half-moon on her left ribs." A perfect freckle, he had once whispered against her skin in that very spot, his lips hovering over it, his breath tickling her flesh. She had laughed, her voice bouncing along the eaves of the barn loft, her fingers slipping through his hair. He had wished on that half-moon many times, silent desires that someday he and Hazel would leave Sparrow, steal away on a ship bound for San Francisco, a new life far away from this town. Maybe if she really had been a witch, his wish muttered softly against her flesh might have come true. But it did not. A gasp passed through the room, and his father lowered the knife from Hazel's throat.
"There it is," his father proclaimed, satisfied. "Proof that she too is a witch."
Hazel felt her heart sink into her gut. The room echoed with murmurs. The finch resumed its chirping. The half-blind elder cleared his throat, speaking loudly enough so that even those outside the town hall with their ears pressed to the doors would hear.
"In our small town, where the ocean brings us life, it shall also take it. The Swan sisters are found guilty of witchcraft
and sentenced to death by drowning, to be carried out at 3 o'clock this afternoon on the summer solstice, an auspicious day for the assurance that their wicked souls will be extinguished permanently.
No,
shouted Aurora. But Marguerite's lips pinched shut, her cold stare enough to curse anyone who dared to look at her. Hazel remained quiet, not because she wasn't afraid, but because she couldn't pull her eyes away from Owen. She could see his regret, his guilt. It wrenched him apart. But he did not condemn her. She and her sisters were doomed the day they arrived in this town. The men seized the three sisters before Hazel could mutter a word to Owen, leading them into a back room where 5 women stripped them naked of their clothes, verified the marks that had been claimed against them, and then dressed them in white gowns to purify their souls and ensure their eternal and absolute death. But absolute, their death was not. Chapter 17. The cottage rattles from the wind, and I wake, gripping for something that isn't there. I had been dreaming of the sea, of the weight of stones pulling me under, water so cold I coughed at first, but then couldn't fight it as it spilled into my lungs. A bleak, lonely death. My sister's only a finger's width away as we all plummeted to the bottom of the harbor. I rub my eyes, crushing away the memory of the dream. It's early, the light outside the cottage still a watercolor of grays, and Beau is stoking the fire. What time is it? I ask, turning over from my place on the floor where I managed to fall asleep. He's added several new logs to the fire, and the heat sears my cheeks and tingles my lips. Early, just after 6. Today is the summer solstice. Tonight, at midnight, everything will change. Beau has been unsuccessful in finding a way to kill the Swan Sisters without also killing the bodies where we reside. There is nothing in any of the books, but I knew there wouldn't be. And I know what he's thinking as he faces the fireplace. Today, he will get his revenge for his brother's death, even if it means killing an innocent girl. He won't allow Aurora to keep on killing. He will end her life. But I've also made a decision. I'm not going back into the water tonight. I won't return to the sea. I'm going to fight to keep this body. I want to stay Penny Talbot, even if it means she no longer gets to exist. Even if it might be impossible, painful and severe and terrifying, I have to try. Each summer, my sisters and I are given only a few short weeks inside the bodies we've stolen, making each day, each hour, precious and fleeting. And so we have a habit of lingering inside our bodies until the final seconds before midnight on the summer solstice. We want to feel every last moment above the waterline, breathe in our last gulps of air, peer up at the sky, dark and gray and infinite, touch the soil beneath our feet, and savor the feeling of being alive. Even when the draw of the harbor begins to pulse behind our eyes, coaxing us back to its cold depth, we resist until it becomes unbearable. We hold on to those final seconds for as long as we can. And there have been summers past when we've pushed it too far, waited too long to return to the sea. It's happened to each of us at least once. In those times, in those seconds that ticked past midnight, a flash of bright pain whipped through our skulls. But the pain isn't all you feel. There is something else. A pressure. Like being stuffed down into the dark, into the deepest shadows of the body we occupied. When it happened to me many years back, I could sense the girl rising once again to the surface, and I was being crushed. We were swapping places. Wherever she had been, hidden, stifled, and suppressed inside the body, I was now sinking into that very place. It was only when I returned to the sea that I slipped free from the girl's skin. The relief was immediate. I swore I would never cut it that close again. I would never risk being trapped in a body after midnight. But this year, this summer solstice, I'm going to try. Maybe I can fight it. Resist the pain and the grinding force pushing me down. Maybe I'm stronger now. More deserving, even. Maybe this year will be different. I haven't taken a single boy's life. Perhaps the curse will release me. Allow me this one thing. Just like in the books I've read about the mermaids and selkies who found a way to be human and exist above the sea, I'm going to stay in this body. Even if Penny will be stifled indefinitely, I'm willing to be selfish to have this. I need to go into town, I say, my voice scratchy. Last night, sitting beside the oak tree, I realized that if I truly want to have this life with Beau, if I love him, then I need to let go of the one thing I've been holding on to. For what? He asks. There's something I need to do. You can't go by yourself. It's too dangerous. I pull down the royal blue t-shirt that wrapped itself around my torso while I slept, tossing and turning fitfully as I battled my nightmares. I have to do this alone. I yank on the dark gray sweatshirt I was using as a pillow, then stand up. What if one of those guys, Davis or Lon, sees you? They might question you about Gigi. I'll be fine, I tell him. And someone needs to stay here, keep an eye on Gigi. He knows I'm right, but the green of his eyes settles on me like he's trying to hold me in place with his stare. Promise me you'll stay away from her while I'm gone. Time is running out, he reminds me. I know. I won't be gone long. Just don't do anything until I get back. He nods, but it's a weak, uncommitted nod. The longer I'm off the island, the greater the risk that something bad will happen. Beau will kill Gigi. Gigi will seduce Beau and coax him into the ocean where she'll drown him. Either way, someone will die. I leave the cottage, closing the door behind me. And then another thought. A new fear rises inside my gut. What if Gigi tells Beau what I really am? Would he even believe her? Doubtful, but it might edge a sliver of suspicion into his mind. I have to go quickly, and hope nothing happens before I get back. The harbor is crowded, fishing boats and tour barges chugging out past the lighthouse. The clouds are low and heavy, so close it feels like I could reach up and touch them, swirl them with my fingertip. But no rain spills from their bloated bellies. It waits, just like everyone is waiting for the next drowned body to be found, the last of the season. But I'm the only sister who has yet to make a kill, and I refuse to do the thing I know both Aurora and Marguerite want me to do. Drown Beau. It's never happened before. A summer where one of us didn't make a single kill. I don't know what will happen, how it will change things, change me, if at all. I feel the sea already, tugging at me, calling me back into the water. The need to return will grow stronger as the day wears on. It happens every year. A pulse behind my eyes, a twitch inside my ribs, drawing me back to the harbor, back into the deep where I belong. But I ignore the sensation. The skiff motors past the orange buoys and through the marina, gliding into place at the dock. Sparrow is teeming with tourists. Along the boardwalk, kids run with rainbow-colored kites, struggling to get them airborne without any breeze. One is even tangled around a street lamp, with a little girl tugging against the string trying to pull it down. Seagulls peck along the concrete for scraps of popcorn and cotton candy. People stroll the shops. They buy saltwater taffy by the pound. They take pictures beside the marina. They know the end is near. Today is the last day. The season is coming to a close. They will return to their normal lives, their normal homes and normal towns, where bad things never happen. but I live in a place where bad things surround me, where I am a bad thing. I don't want to be that anymore. I move in the opposite direction of Copper's Beach and the boathouse, and I head up to Alder Hill at the south end of town, the same part of Sparrow where I was supposed to deliver a vial of rosewater and myrrh perfume the day I met Owen Clement. I never made the delivery. Blackbirds circle above, eyes roving the ground, following me, like they know where I'm headed. Alder Hill is also the location of the Sparrow Cemetery. The graveyard is a broad, grassy plot of land encircled by a partially fallen-down metal fence overlooking the bay so that the fishermen buried here can watch over the sea and protect the town. I haven't been here in a very long time. I've avoided this place for the last century, but I find my way to the tombstone easily, my feet guiding me even after all these years, past graves covered in flowers, and graves covered in moss, and graves left bare. It's one of the oldest stone markers in the cemetery. The only reason it hasn't turned to dust is because for the first century I made sure to keep the weeds from growing over it and the earth from pulling it under. But then it became too hard to come. I was holding on to someone who I would never see again. It was my past, and the person I had become, a murderer, was not who he had loved. I was someone else. It's a simple marker, rounded sandstone. The name and date carved into the rock have long ago been smoothed away by wind and rain. But I know what it used to say. I know it by heart. Owen Clement died 1823. After the day his father caught us together in the barn's loft, Owen wasn't allowed to leave the island. I tried to see him. I rode across the bay. I pleaded with his father, but he forced me away. He was so certain I had cast a spell on Owen to make him love me, that no boy could love a Swan Sister without the sway of some hex or wicked enchantment. If only love were so easily conjured, there wouldn't be so many broken hearts, I remember Marguerite saying once, back when we were alive. I didn't realize what was coming, what Owen's father was plotting. If I had known, I wouldn't have stayed in Sparrow. Clouds hung heavy over the town the day my sisters and I were led from the courthouse down to the docks. Aurora wailed, screaming at the men as they forced us aboard a boat. Marguerite spit curses into their faces. But I remained still, scanning the crowd of gathered spectators for Owen. I had lost sight of him after we were taken into a small dark room at the back of the courthouse, stripped bare and forced into simple white gowns. Our death gowns. They knotted rope around our wrists and ankles. Aurora continued to weep, tears making lines down her cheeks. And then, just as the boat pushed back from the dock, I saw him. Owen. It took three men to restrain him. He yelled my name, scrambling to the end of the dock. But the boat was already drifting too far away, with his father and several other men steering us out to the deepest part of the harbor. I lost sight of him in the low fog that settled over the water, muffling all sound and obscuring the dock where he stood. My sisters and I sat together on a single wood bench at the bow of the boat, shoulders pressed together, hands bound in front of us, prisoners being led to their death. The sea spray stung our faces as the boat pushed farther out into the harbor. I closed my eyes, feeling its cool relief. I listened to the harbor bell buoy ringing at long intervals, the wind and waves gone nearly still. One last moment to breathe the sharp air. The seconds stretched out, and I felt as if I could slip into a dream and never wake, like none of it was real. It's rare to know your death is approaching, waiting for you. Death's fingers already grasping for your soul. I felt it reaching out for me. I was already half gone. The boat drifted to a stop, and I opened my eyes to the sky. A seagull slipped out from the clouds, then vanished again. The men tied burlap sacks filled with stones to our ankles. The stones likely pulled up from a farmer's rocky fields behind town, donated for the occasion of our death. We were forced to stand, then pushed to the edge of the boat. Marguerite eyed one of the younger boys, her gaze clawing into him, as if she might be able to convince him to free her. But we would not be spared. My sisters and I were finally being punished. Adultery, lust, and even true love would find atonement at the bottom of the sea. I sucked in a breath of air, bracing myself for what would come next, when I saw the bow of another boat breaking through the fog. "What the hell?" I heard one of the men say behind us. It was a small boat, oars driving fast through the water. Aurora turned and looked at me. She realized who it was before I did. He stole a boat. A second later, I felt the swift push of two hands against my back. The water shattered around my body like razors, knocking the air from my lungs. Death is not a fire. Death is a cold so fierce it feels like it will peel the skin away from your bones. I sank quickly, my sisters plummeting just as swiftly through the murky water beside me. I thought death would take me quickly. A second, maybe two. But then there was movement above me. An explosion of bubbles and a hand wrapping around my waist. I opened my eyes and focused through the dark, speckled with bits of shell and sand and green. A haze dividing us. But he was there. Owen. He grabbed hold of my arms and began tugging me upward toward the surface, fighting the cold and the weight of the rocks around my feet. His legs kicked furiously, while mine hung limp, tied together. His face strained, eyes wide. He was desperate, trying to save me before the water found its way down my throat and into my lungs. But the stones around my ankles were too heavy. His fingers worked at the rope, but the tension was too great, the knots too stiff. Our eyes met, only inches apart as we sank deeper to the bottom of the harbor. There was nothing he could do. I shook my head frantically, pleading with him to give up, to release me. I tried to pry his hands off of me, but he refused to let go. He was falling too deep, too far. He wouldn't have enough air to make it back up. But he pulled me against him and kissed his frigid lips to mine. I closed my eyes and felt him against me. It's the last thing I remember, before I drew in a breath and the water spilled down my throat. He never let me go, even when it was too late, even when he knew he couldn't save me. We both lost our lives in the harbor that day. The following summer, when I returned to the town for the first time, hidden in the body of a local girl, I walked up the steep slope to Sparrow Cemetery and stood on the cliff over his grave. No one knew who I really was. Hazel Swan, come to see the boy she loved, now buried in the ground. The day we both drowned, his body eventually drifted to the surface of the harbor, and his father was forced to pull his only son from the sea, a fate that he had set in motion. Guilt seethed through my veins as I stood over his freshly dug grave so long ago. His life had ended because of me, and that guilt quickly turned to hatred for the town. All these years, my sisters sought revenge for their own death, but I wanted revenge for Owen's. He sacrificed himself to try to save me, maybe because he felt he had betrayed me, for the trial, for confessing to having seen the mark of a witch on my skin. He believed he caused my death, but I caused his. I should have died that day. I should have drowned. But I didn't. And I've never forgiven myself for what happened to him. For the life we never got to have. I kneel down beside the grave, brushing away the leaves and dirt. "I'm sorry," I begin, then stop myself. It's not enough. He's been gone for nearly 200 years, and I've never said goodbye. Not really. Not until now. I lower my head.